Chapter 3. What the Red Glare Meant. On the tempest-racked night of November 8th, 1921, with a lantern which cast charnel shadows, I stood digging alone and idiotically in the grave of Jan Martens. I'd begun to dig in the afternoon because a thunderstorm was brewing, and now that it was dark and the storm had burst above the maniacally thick foliage, I was glad. I believe that my mind was partially unhinged by events since August 5th. The demon shadow in the mansion, the general strain and disappointment, and the thing that occurred at the hamlet in the October storm. After that thing, I had dug a grave for one whose death I could not understand. I knew that others could not understand either, so I let them think that Arthur Munro had wandered away. They searched, but found nothing. The squatters might have understood, but I feared not frighten them more. I myself seemed strangely callous. The shock at the mansion had done something to my brain, and I could think only of the quest for a horror now grown to cataclysmic stature in my imagination, a quest which the fate of Arthur Munro made me vow to keep silent and solitary. The scene of my excavations would alone have been enough to unnerve any ordinary man. Baleful, primal trees of an unholy size, age, and grotesqueness leered above me like the pillars of some hellish druidic temple. Muffling the thunder, hushing the clawing wind, and emitting but little rain. Beyond the scarred trunks in the background, illumined by faint flashes of filtered lightning, rose the damp, ivied stones of the deserted mansion. While somewhat nearer was the abandoned Dutch garden, whose walks and beds were polluted by a white, fungus-fetid, over-nourished vegetation that never saw full daylight. And nearest of all was the graveyard, where deformed trees tossed insane branches as their roots displaced unhallowed slabs and sucked venom from what lay below. Now and then, beneath the brown pool of leaves that rotted and festered in the antediluvian forest darkness, I could trace the sinister outlines of some of those low mounds which characterised the lightning-pierced region. History had led me to this archaic grave. History, indeed, was all I had after everything else ended in mocking Satanism. I now believed that the lurking fear was no material thing but a wolf-fanged ghost that rode the midnight lightning. And I believed, because of the masses of local tradition I had unearthed in my search with Arthur Munro, that the ghost was that of Jan Martens, who died in 1762. That is why I was digging idiotically at his grave. The Martens mansion was built in 1670 by Gerrit Martens, a wealthy New Amsterdam merchant who disliked the changing order under British rule, and had constructed this magnificent domicile on a remote woodland summit whose untrodden solitude and unusual scenery pleased him. The only substantial disappointment encountered in this site was that which concerned the prevalence of violent thunderstorms in summer. When selecting the hill and building his mansion, Mynheer Martens had laid these frequent natural outbursts as some peculiarity of the year, but in time he perceived that the locality was especially liable to such phenomena. At length, having found these storms injurious to his health, he fitted up a cellar in which he could retreat from their wildest pandemonium. Of Gerrit Martens' descendants less is known than of himself, since they were all reared in hatred of the English civilization, and trained to shun such the colonists as accepted it. Their life was exceedingly secluded, and people declared that their isolation had made them heavy of speech and comprehension. In appearance, all were marked by a peculiar inherited dissimilarity of eyes, one generally being blue and the other brown. Their social contacts grew fewer and fewer, till at last they took to intermarrying with numerous menial class about the estate. Many of the crowded family degenerated, moved across the valley and merged with the mongrel population, which was later to produce the pitiful squatters. The rest had stuck sullenly to their ancestral mansion, becoming more and more clannish and taciturn, yet developing a nervous responsiveness to the frequent thunderstorms. Most of this information reached the outside world through young Jan Martens, who, for some kind of restlessness, joined the colonial army when news of the Albany Convention reached Tempest Mountain. He was the first of Gerrit's descendants to see much of the outside world, and when he returned in 1760, after 6 years of campaigning, he was hated as an outsider by his father, uncles, and brothers, in spite of his dissimilar Martens eyes. No longer could he share the peculiarities and prejudices of the Martenses, while the very mountain thunderstorms failed to intoxicate him as they had before. Instead, his surroundings depressed him, and he frequently wrote to a friend in Albany of plans to leave the paternal roof. In the spring of 1763, Jonathan Gifford, the Albany friend of Jan Martens, became worried by his correspondent's silence, especially in view of the conditions and quarrels at the Martens mansion. Determined to visit Jan in person, he went into the mountains on horseback. His diary states that he'd reached Tempest Mountain on September 20th, finding the mansion in great decrepitude. The sullen, odd-eyed Martenses, whose unclean animal aspect shocked him, told him in broken gutturals that Jan was dead. He had, they insisted, been struck by lightning the autumn before, and now lay buried behind the neglected sunken gardens. They shewed their visitor the grave, barren and devoid of markers. Something in the Martenses' manner gave Gifford a feeling of repulsion and suspicion, and a week later he returned with spade and mattock to explore the sepulchral spot. He found what he expected, a skull crushed cruelly as if by savage blows. So, returning to Albany, he openly charged the Martenses with the murder of their kinsman. Legal evidence was lacking, but the story spread rapidly round the countryside, and from that time the Martenses were ostracised by the world. No one would deal with them, and their distant manor was shunned as an accursed place. Somehow they managed to live on independently by the products of their estate, for occasional lights glimpsed from faraway hills attested that their continued presence. These lights were seen as late as 1810, but towards the last they became very infrequent. Meanwhile, there grew up about the mansion and the mountain a body of diabolic legendary. The place was avoided with doubled assiduousness, and invested with every whispered myth tradition could supply. It remained unvisited till 1816, when the continued absence of lights was noticed by the squatters. At that time, a party made investigations, finding the house deserted and partly in ruins. There were no skeletons about, so that departure rather than death was inferred. The clan seemed to have left several years before, and improvised penthouses shewed how numerous it had grown prior to its migration. Its cultural level had fallen very low, as proven by decayed furniture and scattered silverware, which must have been long abandoned when its owners left. But though the dreaded Martenses were gone, the fear of the haunted house continued and grew very acute when new and strange stories arose among the mountain decadents. There it stood, deserted, feared, and linked with the vengeful ghost of Jan Martens. There it still stood on the night I dug in Jan Martens' grave. I have described my protracted digging as idiotic, and such it indeed was in my object and method. The coffin of Jan Martens had soon been unearthed. It now held only dust and nitre, but in my fury to exhume his ghost, I delved irrationally and clumsily down beneath where he had lain. God knows what I expected to find. I only felt that I was digging in the grave of a man whose ghost stalked by night. It is impossible to say what monstrous depth I had attained when my spade and soon my feet broke through to a ground beneath. The event, under the circumstances, was tremendous, for in the existence of subterranean space here, my mad theories had terrible confirmation. My slight fall had extinguished the lantern, but I produced an electric pocket lamp and viewed the small horizontal tunnel which led away indefinitely in both directions. It was ample large enough for a man to wriggle through, and though no sane person would have tried it at the time, I forgot danger, reason, and cleanliness in my single-minded fever to unearth the lurking fear. Choosing the direction toward the house, I scrambled recklessly into the narrow burrow, squirming ahead blindly and rapidly, and flashing but seldom the lamp I kept before me. What language can describe the spectacle of a man lost in infinitely abysmal earth, pouring, twisting, wheezing and scrambling madly through sunken convolutions of immemorial blackness, without an idea of time, safety, direction, or definite object? There is something hideous in it, but that is what I did. I did it for so long that life faded to be far memory, and I became one with the moles and grubs of nighted depths. Indeed, it was only by accident that after interminable writhings I jarred my forgotten electric lamp alight, so that it shone eerily along the burrow of caked loam that stretched and curved ahead. I had been scrambling in this way for some time, so that my battery had burned very low, when the passage suddenly inclined sharply upward, altering my mode of progression. And, as I raised my glance, it was without preparation that I saw, glistening in the distance, two demoniac reflections of my expiring lamp. Two reflections glowing with a baneful and unmistakable effulgence, and provoking maddeningly nebulous memories. I stopped automatically, though lacking the brain to retreat. The eyes approached, yet of the thing that bore them I could distinguish only a claw. But what a claw! Then far ahead I heard a faint crashing which I recognised. It was the wild thunder of the mountain, raised to hysteric fury. I must have been crawling upward for some time, so that the surface was now quite near. And as the muffled thunder clattered, those eyes still stared with vacuous viciousness. Thank God I did not then know what it was, else I should have died. But I was saved by the very thunder that had summoned it, for after a hideous wait there burst from the unseen outside sky one of the frequent mountainward bolts whose aftermath I had noticed here and there as gashes of disturbed earth and fulgurites of various sizes. With cyclopean rage it tore through the soil above that damnable pit, blinding and deafening me, yet not whole, reducing me to a coma. In the chaos of sliding, shifting earth, I clawed and floundered helplessly till the rain on my head steadied me, and I saw that I had come to the surface in a familiar spot. A steep, unforested place on the southwest slope of the mountain. Recurrent sheet lightning illumined the tumbled ground, and the remains of the curious low hummock which had stretched down from the wooded slope, higher slope. But there was nothing in the chaos to shew my place of egress from that lethal catacomb. My brain was as great a chaos as the earth, and as a distant red glare burst on the landscape from the south, I hardly realised the horror I had been through. But when, 2 days later, the squatters told me what the red glare meant, I felt more horror than that which the mould burrow and the claws and the eyes had given me. More horror because of the overwhelming implications. In a hamlet 20 miles away, an orgy of fear had followed the bolt which brought me above ground, and a nameless thing had dropped from an overhanging tree into a weak roofed cabin. It had done a deed, but the squatters had fired the cabin in a frenzy before it could escape. It had been doing that deed at the very moment the earth caved in on the thing with the claw and eyes. Chapter 4. The Horror in the Eyes. There can be nothing normal in the mind of one who, knowing what I knew of the horrors of Tempest Mountain, would seek alone for the fear that lurked there. That at least two of the fear's embodiments were destroyed, formed but a slight guarantee of mental and physical safety in this Acheron of multiform diabolism. Yet, I continued my quest with even greater zeal as the events and revelations became more monstrous. When, 2 days after my frightful crawl through that crypt of the eyes and claw, I learned that a thing had malignly hovered 20 miles away at the same instant the eyes were glaring at me, I experienced virtual convulsions of fright. But that fright was so mixed with wonder and alluring grotesqueness that it was almost a pleasant sensation. Sometimes, in the throes of a nightmare, when unseen powers whirl one over the roofs of strange dead cities towards the grinning chasm of Nice, it is a relief and even a delight to shriek wildly and throw oneself voluntarily along with the hideous vortex of dream doom into whatever bottomless gulf may yawn. And so it was with the waking nightmare of Tempest Mountain. The discovery that two monsters had haunted the spot gave me ultimately a mad craving to plunge into the very earth of the accursed region, and with bare hands dig out the death that leered from every inch of the poisonous soil. As soon as possible, I visited the grave of Jan Martens and dug vainly where I had dug before. Some extensive cave-in had obliterated all trace of the underground passage, while the rain had washed so much earth back into the excavation that I could not tell how deeply I had dug the other day. I likewise made a difficult trip to the distant hamlet where the death creature had been burnt, and was little repaid for my trouble. In the ashes of the fateful cabin I found several bodies, but apparently none of the monsters. The squatters said the thing had only one victim, but in this I judged them inaccurate, since, beside the complete skull of a human being, there was another bony fragment which seemed certainly to have belonged to a human skull at some time. Though the rapid drop of the monster had been seen, no one could say just what the creature was like. Those who had glimpsed it called it simply a devil. Examining the great tree where it had lurked, I could discern no distinctive marks. I tried to find some trail in the Black Forest, but on this occasion could not stand the sight of those morbidly large boles, or those vast serpent-like roots that twisted so malevolently before they sank into the earth. My next step was to re-examine, with microscopic care, the deserted hamlet where death had come most abundantly, and where Arthur Munro had seen something he never lived to describe. Though my vain previous searches had been exceedingly minute, I now had new data to test. For my horrible grave crawl convinced me that at least one of those phases of the monstrosity had been an underground creature. This time, on the 14th of November, my quest concerned itself mostly with the slopes of Combe Mountain and Maple Hill, where they overlook the unfortunate hamlet. I gave particular attention to the loose earth of the landslide region of the latter eminence. The afternoon of my search brought nothing to light, and dusk came as I stood on Maple Hill, looking down at the hamlet and across the valley to Tempest Mountain. There had been a gorgeous sunset, and now the moon came up nearly full and shedding a silver flood over the plain, the distant mountainside, and the curious low mounds that rose here and there. It was a peaceful Arcadian scene, but knowing what it hid, I hated it. I hated the mocking moon, the hypocritical plain, the festering mountain, and those sinister mounds. Everything seemed to me tainted with a loathsome contagion, and inspired by a noxious alliance with distorted, hidden powers. Presently, as I gazed abstractedly at the moonlit panorama, my eye became attracted by something singular in the nature and arrangement of a certain topographical element. Without having any exact knowledge of geology, I had from the first been interested in the odd mounds and hummocks of the region. I had noticed that they were pretty widely distributed among Tempest Mountain, although less numerous on the plains than near the hilltop itself, where prehistoric glaciation had doubtless found feebler opposition to its striking and fantastic caprices. Now, in the light of that low moon which cast long, weird shadows, it struck me forcibly that the various points and lines of the mound system had a peculiar relation to the summit of Tempest Mountain. That summit was undeniably a centre from which the line or rows of points radiated indefinitely and irregularly, as if the unwholesome Martens Mountain had thrown visible tentacles of terror. The idea of such tentacles gave me an unexplained thrill, and I stopped to analyse my reason for believing these mounds glacial phenomena. The more I analysed, the less I believed, and against my newly opened mind there began to beat grotesque and horrible analogies based on superficial aspects and upon my experience beneath the earth. Before I knew it, I was uttering frenzied and disjointed words to myself. My God, molehills. The damned place must be honeycombed. How many? That night at the mansion. They took Bennett and Toby first, one on each side of us. Then I was digging frantically into the mountain which had stretched nearest me, digging desperately, shiveringly, but almost jubilantly. Digging, and at last shrieking aloud with some unplaced emotion as I came upon a tunnel or burrow just like the one through which I had crawled on that other demoniac night. After that, I recall running, spade in hand, a hideous run across moon-litten, mound-marked meadows and through diseased, precipitous abysses of haunted hillside forests. Leaping, screaming, pounding, bounding towards the terrible Martens Mansion. I recall digging unreasoningly in all parts of the briar-choked cellar, digging to find the core and centre of that malignant universe and mounds. And then I recall how I laughed when I stumbled on the passageway, the hole at the base of the old chimney, where the thick weeds grew and cast queer shadows in the light of the lone candle I had happened to have with me. What still remained down in that hell hive, lurking and waiting for the thunder to arouse it, I did not know. Two had been killed. Perhaps that had finished it. But still, there remained that burning determination to reach the innermost secret of the fear, which I had once more come to deem definite, material and organic. My indecisive speculation whether to explore the passageway alone and immediately with my pocket light, or to try and assemble a band of squatters for the quest, was interrupted after a time by a sudden rush of wind from outside, which blew out the candle and left me in stark blackness. The moon no longer shone through the chinks and apertures above me, and with a sense of fateful alarm I heard the sinister and significant rumble of approaching thunder. A confusion of associated ideas possessed my brain, leading me to grope back towards the farthest corner of the cellar. My eyes, however, never turned away from the horrible opening at the base of the chimney, and I began to get glimpses of the crumbling bricks and unhealthy weeds as faint glows of lightning penetrated the woods outside and illumined the chinks in the upper wall. Every second I was consumed with a mixture of fear and curiosity. What would the storm call forth? Or was there anything left for it to call? Guided by a lightning flash, I settled myself down behind a dense clump of vegetation through which I could see the opening without being seen. If heaven is merciful, it will someday efface from my consciousness the sight that I saw, and let me live my last years in peace. I cannot sleep at night now, and have to take opiates when it thunders. The thing came abruptly and unannounced, a daemon, rat-like, scurrying from pits remote and unimaginable. A hellish panting, a stifled grunting, and then from that opening beneath the chimney, a burst of multitudinous and leprous life. A loathsome, night-spawned flood of organic corruption, more devastatingly hideous than the blackest conjurations of mortal madness and morbidity. Seething, stewing, surging, bubbling like serpent slime, it rolled up and out of that yawning hole, spreading like a septic contagion and screaming from the cellar at every point of egress, streaming out to scatter through the accursed midnight forest and strew fear, madness and death. God knows how many there were. There must have been thousands. To see the stream of them in that faint, intermittent lightning was shocking. When they had thinned out enough to be glimpsed as separate organisms, I saw that they were dwarfed, deformed, hairy devils or apes, monstrous and diabolic caricatures of the monkey tribe. They were so hideously silent. There was hardly a squeal when one of the last stragglers turned with the skill of long practice to make a meal in an accustomed fashion on a weaker companion. Others snapped up what it left and ate with slavering relish. Then, in spite of my days of fright and disgust, my morbid curiosity triumphed. And, as the last of the monstrosities oozed up alone from that netherworld of unknown nightmare, I drew my automatic pistol and shot it under the cover of the thunder. Shrieking, slithering, torrential shadows of red, viscous madness chasing one after another through endless, ensanguined corridors of purple, fulgurous sky. Formless phantasms and kaleidoscopic mutations of a ghoulish, remembered scene. Forests of monstrous, overnourished oaks with serpent roots twisting and sucking unnameable juices from an earth verminous with millions of cannibal devils. Mound-like tentacles groping from underground nuclei of prolipus perversion. Insane lightning over maligned ivied walls and daemon arcades choked with fungus vegetation. Heaven be thanked for the instinct which led me unconscious to places where men dwelt, to the peaceful village that slept under the calm stars of clearing skies. I had recovered enough in a week to send to Albany for a gang of men to blow up the Martens Mansion and the entire top of Tempest Mountain with dynamite, stop up all the discoverable mound burrows and destroy certain overnourished trees whose very existence seemed an insult to sanity. I could sleep a little after they had done this, but true rest will never come as long as I remember that nameless secret of the lurking fear. The thing will haunt me, for who can say the extermination is complete, and that analogous phenomena do not exist all over the world? Who can, with my knowledge, think of the earth's unknown caverns without a nightmare dread of future possibilities? I cannot see a well or a subway entrance without shuddering. Why cannot the doctors give me something to make me sleep, or truly clan my brain when it thunders? What I saw in the glow of my flashlight after I shot the unspeakable, straggling object was so simple that almost a minute elapsed before I understood and went delirious. The object was nauseous. A filthy, whitish gorilla thing with sharp yellow fangs and matted fur. It was the ultimate product of mammalian degeneration. The frightful outcome of isolated spawning, multiplication and cannibal nutrition above and below the ground. The embodiment of all the snarling chaos and grinning fear that lurk behind life. It had looked at me as it died, and its eyes had the same odd quality that marked those other eyes which had stared at me underground and excited cloudy recollections. One eye was blue, the other brown. They were the dissimilar Martense eyes of the old legends, and I knew in one inundating cataclysm of voiceless horror what had become of that vanished family, the terrible and thunder-crazed house of Martense.